The History Show with Maz Duncan.
Good evening and welcome to The History Show on RTE Radio 1. On this week's programme, 100 years ago today, the armistice brought an end to the fighting in World War I, the so-called war to end all wars.
Hostilities will cease at 11 hours today, the 11th of November 1918. There will be no intercourse of any description with the enemy until receipt of further instructions.
Ireland paid a heavy price in the conflict while thousands upon thousands of Irishmen fought in the British Army.
Every single county in Ireland was affected by the war. Every little townland probably has some connection to the war itself.
On tonight's programme, we'll hear some of their stories and explore the effect the end of the war had on Ireland at this crucial historical moment.
The news had brought all able-bodied people out onto the streets, shouting, singing, waving flags. Some houses were silent.
We begin this evening at St Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, where a sculptural installation honours the Irish who died in World War I. It's called the Tree of Remembrance, and it collects thousands of leaf-shaped messages symbolising Irish people killed during the conflict. Earlier, Rona Tarrant paid a visit.
In St Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, Aitine Murphy is showing me letters her father inherited from his cousins.
Walter, Dorothy and Edith Quinn. They were the children of the Reverend William Quinn, who was rector in Finvoy, County Antrim.
Throughout their lives, these three siblings wrote to each other every week and continued after Walter signed up to fight in World War I.
Edith and Dorothy to each other and to Walter and Walter back home.
Walter's journey to France began here in Dublin, where he was studying at Trinity College in the hope of becoming a clergyman.
So he did classics and philosophy.
Walter had failed a medical when he first attempted to join the army, but in December 1916, when he was 19 years old, he decided to try again.
Instead of taking the train north to go home to his family, he walks into a recruiting office and impulsively offers himself and is accepted to his great delight. He should never have been accepted because he failed. The doctor examining him said his visual ability was below standard.
But after 6 months of training, Walter was sent to France and wrote home to his sisters.
Just after arriving in France, he says, "Here we are in the war. In Dublin we had a great send-off. The streets were packed and there was the utmost enthusiasm."
The reality of the war soon hit. A month later, he writes home about the Battle of Passchendaele.
He says, "I have had a baptism of fire carrying up ammunition. We carried it through a belt of land, every inch of which had been turned up several times by shell fire. Twice I was thrown down by explosions. Once I was struck in the back by a brick thrown up by a shell. An officer was shot dead just beside me. In fact, I have had a very lively time indeed."
Walter continued to write regularly to his sisters, mostly about his daily life, including the book club he joined and missing the sound of organ music.
It was apparently 90% boredom and 10% panic.
Walter Quinn is just one of the more than 220,000 Irish people who participated in World War I, whose stories are being remembered here in St Patrick's Cathedral. Andrew Smith is education officer.
What we're finding since we've opened this installation is just this huge level of interest, and people are coming forward with their stories. They just want somebody to hear the story, you know, because I think that perhaps in the past they've been a little reticent to share it. For whatever reason, it's a kind of a hidden part of Irish history.
Andrew says one of the reasons why the stories weren't shared was because remembrance became politicised.
And to remember someone from World War I had a connotation of something which some people weren't too happy about.
But he says that's changing, and around the anniversary of the armistice, stories like Walter Quinn's are being shared and remembered here in St Patrick's. The final letter from Walter Quinn came 2 weeks after his 21st birthday in May 1918, when he was admitted to hospital in Bologna with a minor wound.
"You need not be anxious about me. The MO has successful surgeon written all over his face, and the nurses leave not a thing to be desired."
But 3 weeks later, Walter's family received word that he had died of septicemia.
"And he's buried in a cemetery near Bologna."
The letters between Walter's sisters continued after his death. On November 10th, 1918, the day before the armistice and just a few months after losing her only brother, Dorothy wrote to Edith.
"Tomorrow holds many a secret to reveal. I do wonder what news it will bring. Yes or no by 11 a.m. I simply can't imagine the war being over. With the joy of peace and the thought of no more wholesale murder, I am afraid there will be few homes without an aching heart.
That was Rona Tarrant reporting there from St Patrick's Cathedral in Dublin, where that sculptural installation honours the Irish people who made the ultimate sacrifice during World War I. And if you want to see the installation for yourself, it remains in place until the 1st of December. The project raises many important questions, such as what did the end of the war mean for the families of those who died? And for those soldiers who did come back, how did the Ireland they had left welcome them home? This is the voice from the RTE archives of an unnamed soldier describing how he felt when the armistice was declared.
I don't know what the sensation was. You were glad, certainly, but you got so used to everything, you took it as a matter of course. You never entered your head. It was finished and that was that.
A very matter-of-fact reaction there to the declaration of the armistice. I'm joined in studio by two guests who've researched individual stories of Irish people involved in the war. Tom Burke is a founding member of the Royal Dublin Fusiliers Association, and Cathy Scuffell is a Dublin City Council historian in residence for the South Central area. You're both very, very welcome indeed. Tom, what was the reaction in general of the soldiers of the Dublin Fusiliers on hearing the news of the armistice?
Well, there were no great celebrations in the lines. There was a certain amount of mistrust that the Germans wouldn't honour it. There were ceasefires before that broke down. However, this one was quite real. The 149th Brigade, in which the 2nd Dublin Fusiliers served, received the following order from Divisional Headquarters. It was timed at about 8:30 in the morning on the 11th of November. And the armistice had been, in fact, signed about 5 earlier on. So it took a few hours for the news to come to the lines. And I'll quote, "Hostilities will cease at 11 hours today, the 11th of November 1918. Defensive precautions will be maintained. There will be no intercourse of any description with the enemy until receipt of further instructions." End quote. So you can see the sentiment there, that there was a certain amount of doubt in that sentiment. So yes, there was no celebrations, no high fives or anything like that. More a feeling of resignation on hearing the news after all.
Cathy, 36,000 Irishmen died in the war. We don't know precisely how many. What impact did that have on local communities across the country?
Well, I suppose the main thing to say is that every single county in Ireland was affected by the war. Every little townland probably has some connection to the war itself. And this would be greatly increased by the fact that there were many brothers and cousins who joined the army together. And this in turn then, the typical Irish situation, the enlarged family, there's a devastating effect on all of the local communities when this happens. If I can give you just one example, Dunfermline, my own home area, I've done a little bit of work there having a look at them, and I estimate that about 100 local men eventually served in World War One from that area, which would have been urban rural Dublin. Over 30 of them never returned. So that's a huge number of young men to lose from one small community. Those that were lost included in the list that I've compiled two sets of brothers, the Wards from Poplar Place on the South Circular Road, which is roughly where Dolphin House is today. The Fitzpatrick brothers, they were from Rialto Buildings, and they lost a cousin also who was also a neighbour. In fact, the Fitzpatricks and their cousin were three of six in total who were lost in the buildings, and many of the people there all had connections to Guinness, so you're also losing workmates and neighbours at the same time. But two more were cousins from Hartleville Avenue, and again these were neighbours, they actually lived next door to each other. And a further two were from that little place called Emerald Square, opposite the Coombe Hospital in Duffus Barn Street, Cork Street. And ironically, that's where Eamon Cant in 1916 mobilised his forces for the South Dublin Union.
You've also been looking at the story of one of the better known, along with Willie Doyle, one of the better known Irish chaplains of the First World War, Canon Gleeson. That was about him.
Yes, Canon Shannon Gleeson is quite an interesting character. He lived in Dolphin's Barn before he became a chaplain in World War One, so we claim him a little bit, if you like. But he kept extensive diaries, and they're precise day-by-day accounts of the mundane, the normal procedures at the front. And when Canon Gleeson came back, he became a chaplain, I think, for the Irish Free States, the National Army, for a short time. And then he went back into diocesan work. And he's famous for being in that painting, The Final Absolution of the Munsters, which was at the Rue de Bois near Ypres. And it's a very emotive painting. It's a, you know, you stop and you look at it in great detail. And of course, the other connection with him is that he later became parish priest in Mead Street in Dublin's Liberties. So St Catherine's Church in Mead Street have great connections with Canon Gleeson.
Now, Major General Sir William Bernard Hickey plays a significant role in the remembrance of Irishmen who fought and died in World War One. Who was he and what did he do?
Okay, so Bernard Hickey, I came across him when I was doing a review of census records on the South Circular Road and couldn't believe that I found him actually living on the South Circular Road in Dublin, quite near Dolphin's Barn in 1911. So I dug a little bit into this because I was wondering why he was there in quite a large house. And it turns out that he had connections with Wellington Barracks, which later became, it's Griffith College today. Mm. And he was just about to be assigned to the Royal Hospital in Kilmainham at that time. He comes from a long military family. They've connections, I think, with Terry Glass. But he's living in Dublin in 1911, about to be assigned to the Royal Hospital. And of course, then World War One breaks out and Major Bernard Hickey, he's away then at the front. So when he comes back, he stays as a career soldier. So he actually joins the Irish National Army and later becomes a senator. And he is, of course, connected with establishing the War Memorial Gardens in Island Bridge. So he's involved in that. So he brings us from war to peace, I think, and brings us from war to memorial.
And Tom, that whole memorialisation issue, which ends with the construction of the war memorial in Island Bridge, was very controversial. There was talk about it being in Stephen's Green, talk about it being in Merrion Square, Phoenix Park. It ends up in Island Bridge. Just talk us through that whole process and what actually happens, the war memorial in the years after it's finally built.
Well, I suppose the concept of an Irish memorial began as early as July 1919 at a meeting in the Viceregal Lodge in Phoenix Park. There were several ideas for such memorials put up, such as a home for the veterans, a memorial hall, even a cenotaph in Merrion Square. Now, for political reasons, the memorial ended up outside the centre of the city, along the banks of the Liffey at Island Bridge. The government's rejection of Merrion Square was satirically referred to in Lord Dunsany's poem to the fallen Irish soldiers, when he noted in the very first line, I quote, "since they have grudged you space in Merrion Square," which I think was rather ironic. But anyway, symbolically, it was built by men from both the British Army and the National Army. Interestingly enough, the cost of a memorial was shared between a group of a war memorial trustees and the Irish government, who in 1931, I think it's an interesting point, put up £50,000. About €3.5 million in today's currency. So that was a fair amount of money for this fledgling Irish government to commit it. And indeed, even De Valera committed himself to the whole opening of the thing. So as time went on, as the veterans died off, so too did the attendance at the remembrance ceremonies, and it fell into dereliction. It was cleaned up and restored in 1988, I think, when it was religious service held in it. But the Memorial Gardens in Island Bridge in many ways reflects Ireland's attitude towards the First World War. The journey that park took is many ways symbolic of our own journey, from glorification, if you like, in the 20s and 30s, to demise in the 50s, 60s and 70s, to be reborn in the 80s, 90s and noughties. Many ways it reflects our attitude as that nation, because we went through that process of indifference to rediscovery, to regeneration, to where it is today, a central focus of commemoration and remembrance.
And also a very, very lovely space and beautiful. A very beautiful amenity.
Beautiful, absolutely.
The armistice, Tom, must have been bittersweet for the families of those who died.
Well, I suppose the celebrations in Dublin and the towns around Ireland on news of the armistice, it wasn't really attended by many of the families and the loved ones who lost their husbands, their sons, their brothers. What were they celebrating? What was the cause of celebration? One can only imagine the sadness that was unleashed in some of the families that did suffer from the war. For example, if you give a little example of, I've always quoted Mrs. MacDonald from Bride Street in Dublin. She lost her three sons in a gas attack between April and May 1915. And in many ways, that war and revolution double hit families in a sense. For example, in that same gas attack, Mrs. Malone from the South Circular Road lost her son, Sergeant Willie Malone. And in the Easter Rising, she lost her son, Captain Michael Malone. And so if I was the father of any of those young men, I'd say, to hell with your wars and your revolutions. Look what it's cost me. Mm. There were a lot of empty chairs. Bear in mind, Christmas was coming around the corner. This was November, but a lot of empty chairs at Christmas tables, both in the big house and the tenement houses of Ireland.
And one can assume there would have been Irish families who would have had the same experience as the family of the poet Wilfred Owen, with the telegram arriving as the church bells are ringing to celebrate the armistice. That must have happened as well. Cathy, during those 4 years, a lot had happened in Ireland, and also a lot had happened to people's attitude to the war.
Again, I'll just take you back to Dolphin's Barn. In 1914, there's a record of a huge recruitment meeting being held in the middle of the crossroads. It's attended by the local councillor, a man called John Scully. He's also your local barman. He owns the local pub and he's your provisions. You could buy your cups and saucers from him. You know, everybody knew him. He gets up and he is saying to them, join up, become part of this great movement. It'd be a shame to leave it to our cousins in Wales and Scotland and England to fight this fight. So a lot of people are encouraged to join. There's a band, there's men in uniform, there's a huge advantage to going. You get shoes on your feet, you get a new set of clothes, a new opportunity. 4 years later, fast forward 4 years, there's another huge meeting held in Dolphin's Barn. Again, we've got an alderman, but this time we've Alderman Michael Flanagan on the podium, accompanied by his son-in-law, W.T. Cosgrave. And the whole tenet of the meeting is anti-conscription. This war is not fashionable anymore. And it's equally attended by a huge crowd of people. So it's a huge change to Ireland in those 4 years.
And an obvious follow-up question, I suppose, how did this shift in opinion affect how the families remembered their loved ones who had died? Were they allowed to do so? Did they feel they could do so?
That's a very good question. I have two lovely examples again that probably illustrate that quite nicely. One of them is no grave to go to. So you have that issue of how do mothers mourn? How do fathers mourn? And you haven't even a grave to go to. So I have one chap, an Albert Dunn from Canalview Terrace on the Crumlin Road, which again is just within the Dolphin's Barn area. Those parents had his name inscribed on the family tombstone in St Mary's Graveyard, Church of Ireland Graveyard in Crumlin Village. But he's buried in France. So I've been at both. I've actually been at both his graves. So he's one example. And then I have another lady, and there's descendants of the family still living in the area. But she was known for going around the area with a large handbag. And she went into certain shops or would approach certain people, and she'd surreptitiously open her handbag and show you what was in it. She was selling the poppy secretly. So like Tom mentioned there, the way our attitude to history and our attitude to those events are summarised in those two little stories. And how do you mourn and how do you remember?
And Tom, how do you mourn when there is no grave to visit, when the grave is in France or the grave is in Belgium and you haven't got two halfpennies to rub together? There's no way you're ever going to make it to France to see the grave.
For Irish families, particularly those of the ordinary soldiers, they simply couldn't afford to visit their loved ones or even visit the memorials. And they had no place to go to pay their respects. So in many ways, Island Bridge fulfilled that function of being able to visit somewhere so they could reflect on what was happening. It wasn't until August 1926 that an Irish delegation went to France, Guillemont and Whitesheet and Flanders, at an unveiling ceremony of two Irish granite crosses, Celtic crosses. There's one, and a similar one in Salonika. So the absence of that body, of a body and a grave, really presented huge problems. And this is where Island Bridge came in. It's only in recent years, in fact, that the creation of the awareness of Ireland's role in the First World War, that families have discovered their dead relatives. Irish people now go to these cemeteries as far away as Salonika. They pay their respects to their relatives. And in many ways, their visitation to these places of remembrance and cemeteries and graveyards on the Western Front, in many ways, the families are giving their loved ones a funeral. And in some of these, I've been at a few of them, and some of them can be very emotional. People actually break down with emotion, laying a wreath and remembering. And that rekindling of family lore, closing a chapter on their family's histories.
The soldiers began to return home relatively quickly, except for prisoners of war. Tell us about what I think is a fascinating double booking on the 21st of January 1919 of the Mansion House.
Yeah, in January, Irish prisoners of war were coming home. But interestingly, on the 21st of January, a day that perhaps encapsulates the interlinking of the salient events in Irish history and how Ireland had changed during the war, the Royal Dublin Fusiliers prisoners of war attended a reception in their honour in the Mansion House at 12:30 in the afternoon. Later on, they went to the Theatre Royal, but as they marched out of the Mansion House, in marched the new Dáil, literally side by side. And on the same day, it was the day when two RIC constables were murdered, killed, assassinated, whatever word you want to use, down in Solihull Bay. So that one day on the 21st of January 1919 literally encapsulates what was going to happen.
I have to say, I had no idea that that it had been double booked.
Well, yes,
not indeed. Exactly double booked, but it's an interesting piece of symbolism. There's no doubt about it. The other two events, much more famous, I suppose, in the Irish canon, the First Dáil and the Solihull Bay, the beginning essentially of the War of Independence. Cathy, the soldiers who fought and died aren't just remembered here. How else has the Irish government remembered Ireland's role, or have others remembered Ireland's role internationally?
Well, I suppose the best examples are those around the Somme area, and particularly around Guillemont and Ginchy in particular. They're places I have visited, and it's quite remarkable when you see a street called Rue de l'Irlandaise, for example. We are recognised much more, I think, in France, in Belgium, than we realise, and they are very, very grateful to us for that. And you find small little things. You go into a church, for example, you'll find a plaque on the wall to one of our lads. You'll find part of the church dedicated to St. Patrick, and that is the Irish wall with various memorials and various pieces put on it. It's quite poignant when you find it, and you're inclined to find it quite unexpectedly. I think more recently too, there's been a more generous attitude towards commemoration, and we also have that beautiful Island of Ireland Memorial Park then in Belgium too. So we're getting better at it. I think we're mature about it. We commemorate the peace more than we commemorate the war.
Would you agree, Tom?
I would indeed. In fact, I think our understanding of the war itself, in effect, and indeed its legacy on Europe and Ireland in particular, has come about over the last 30 years, mainly through a process of educating ourselves about it. That education has come through exhibitions and seminars and books published in the last 30 years. That's been a pleasure of them, informing us, educating us. But the National Library, the National Museum, our own Dublin Fusiliers Association have played a role in that as well. But in terms of the war itself and its utility, I've often described it, presented it as a metaphor for the train station in Liketoe. In August 1914, the 2nd Dublins fought quite near the train station in Liketoe. It's their first shots they'd fired. In October 1918, over four years later, towards the end of the war, the same battalion was back in the same train station fighting the same enemy. And in between those two iconic dates, 9.7 million combatants from all nations had died. And it's even more symbolised by a cemetery in Novelle in Flanders, where you have four headstones, an Irish, English, Scotch and a Welsh. Sounds like a nasty joke, but right beside them, they were killed on the 11th of November 1918. Right beside them, 4 feet away, are four soldiers who died on the 4th of August 1914.
And in some Symphorian cemetery, you have John Parr, who died in August 1914, the first British casualty, and George Ellison, the last British casualty, who literally are a row apart.
But there is another one final, I suppose, to my own opinion, for the legacy of that terrible war, and it was the loss of human potential. Just think about the genius that was lost in battle, the poets, the doctors, the engineers, the potential that we could have had and we never got to know, and sadly we will never know what they could have contributed to an emerging world.
So 100 years ago today, the guns fell silent across Europe. As we've heard, the human cost of World War I was immense, not just for those who fought, but for those who were left behind. Tom Burke and Cathy Scuffle, thank you both very much for joining us and for giving us that insight into this tragic conflict. The Armistice of November 1918 took place, of course, at an important historical moment in Ireland, just before the momentous general election in December. I'm joined by three guests, Kieran Wallace of Trinity College in Dublin, historian Liz Gillis, and Maeve Casserly, an historian in residence with Dublin City Council. Kieran, you've been looking at the reaction on the streets of Dublin on the 11th of November 1918. One thing you found is that there were lots of flags to be seen.
Yes, all the newspapers talk a lot about this. There was huge jubilation. The news seems to have broken out about by noontime anyway. They said all the shops were out of flags and out of bunting. By 3:30, all the pubs were out of beer. But the but the flags going up, the Irish Times and the Evening Herald comment on the number of flags, and they say lots of Union Jacks in evidence. And then they stress that the American flag was much in use. The Irish Times says the tricolour, and I paused for a moment. I thought, oh, not the tricolour, they mean the French tricolour.
Tricolour, yeah.
And they even remark on an odd flag. They said a Union Jack sort of superimposed on a green flag was in evidence in a few places as well. And that made me wonder, with green ribbons on hats and things on the same day, was there something interesting happening with flags and identity on the day, jubilation at the end of the war, but some discomfort about using a Union Jack overtly? Lots of Union Jacks there, but some people demonstrating kind of maybe a mixed loyalty.
There was also a deafening racket, wasn't there?
Yeah, they said from O'Connell Bridge right down to the Alexander Basin, ship sirens going off, the stewards and the crews on board the ships, these were both passenger ships and like coal ships and whatnot, parading around the decks of the ships, banging their pots and pans, sending off rockets, sending up their distress flares in celebration, airplanes flying overhead. So the city was like throbbing with life through the middle of the day, airplanes doing loop-the-loops and crowds oohing and aahing from the streets below. So the real sense of sort of instant festival.
And singing and dancing?
Yes, ragtime singing to the music. They said crowds gathered, soldiers gathered outside the, there was a soldiers' club on College Street. If you know where the Irish Yeast Company is, next door to that, there was a soldiers' club for the duration of the war, like a hostel for soldiers. And the soldiers poured out onto the streets and they danced to ragtime music. They had made with a paper and comb. How loud you could get in ragtime with a paper and comb, I don't know. But this is what they danced to. And even dancing on the roofs of taxis. So this was a proper kind of a mafficking kind of a celebration.
Maeve, tell us about something called the Irish Women's Patrol, because they might have had an attitude towards all this carousing that was taking place on Armistice Day.
Definitely. The Irish Women's Patrol began as a voluntary organisation when the war was kind of in its beginning. And there were some interesting sort of dichotomies going on in the Women's Patrol, because in essence, they were sort of like a moral police. They wouldn't have condoned any of this celebrations going on here now on Armistice Day 100 years ago. But
they were vigilantes, basically.
They were, in a way. But they were led by a number of prominent women in the suffrage movement. One of their chairman, was a lady called Margaret Hayden, who herself was a pioneer in women's education reform, would have been part of the Women's Graduate Association, and was the first female professor of modern history in UCD as well. So there's interesting, because she didn't see an opposition between kind of a moral police in terms of policing people's behaviour, but also getting more rights for women and the right to vote as well.
So radically censorious.
Yeah, exactly.
And what kind of stuff were they doing? I mean, were they, you know, like nuns at dances, at school dances with the torches and the umbrellas?
People are standing too close. That kind of thing, in a way, yes. So apparently they used to go out 2 by 2, up to 10 o'clock in the evening, according to some newspaper reports. They would go around to places where young people could gather socially. So cafes, pubs, anything like that, reading societies, and prevent young women in particular from being taken up by the fever that wartime brings about in young people, and perhaps not being morally wise in their behaviour. So yeah, probably getting a ruler out and separating people when they're not dancing too close to one another and things like that. So being kind of morally vigilant.
Yeah, don't think they would have had too much of a chance on Armistice Day. But anyway, Liz, the celebrations took a rather sinister turn rather quickly. What happened?
Yes, the atmosphere is pretty electric, and you've obviously got this tension that had been building up over the last number of years between the supporters of the British Army and the British government, and then of course Sinn Féin, and so much had changed certainly within the last year. It really kicks off with a number of students that have this mock funeral of the Kaiser, but they wheel it through the city, but it's a tricolour, an Irish tricolour that's draped over this, so that does not go down well with the supporters of Sinn Féin. and then just escalates until you have these attacks then on numerous properties around the sea where you have Sinn Féin representatives and activists based.
And that culminates then in an attack on Sinn Féin offices in Harcourt Street. What happened there?
That's the one that's most reported, is the attack on number 6, which was the headquarters of Sinn Féin. And they were completely caught unawares because they had actually organised a meeting in the Mansion House that night as well, where they were going to be talking about the war because it was still going on. And they're doing campaign work in the offices, and they got word that a number of students from Trinity College, officers in the training corps, were coming over to attack specifically number 6. And the building was pretty much a building site because they were getting works done, and they tried to barricade the building but didn't do it in time. So you have the supporters of the armistice and the British Army where they're storming the building. You have women and members of Cumann na mBan that are picking up anything they have to hand, including coal, and throwing it down at the attackers. Now, lucky enough, you have Harry Boland and Simon Donnelly, who are both members of the Irish Volunteers, and they get word that this is happening. So they run down, fire over the heads of the crowds, and that disperses them. But it came a little bit too late because in this attack, you had a number of people injured, both attackers and defenders.
And one of the people who was injured, Seamus O'Kelly, dies a couple of days after the attack. Tell us about Seamus O'Kelly.
Yeah, Seamus O'Kelly has completely been airbrushed out of history and the history of Armistice Day, because this is actually a tragedy that happens on Armistice Day. And he had suffered from ill health, but he himself was the deputy editor of Nationality, the newspaper, Sinn Féin's newspaper. He's busy doing his work. But when the attackers come, he is attacked, and he tries to defend himself with his walking stick. That's all he had to hand. But he either suffered, it was a heart attack or a hemorrhage as a result of the attack. The accounts differ as to actually what he died from. The fact of the matter is, he died 2-3 days later. But he does not get a mention anywhere in the events of this day or the, you know, of what happened.
And was 6 Harcourt Street the only place to be attacked?
No, you have this, just it seems, a rampage going on anything that has a connection with Sinn Féin and the Labour movement as well. So while number 6 is being attacked, at the same time you have the Mansion House being attacked. And these are all reported in the newspaper 2-3 days later. On the 14th of November, you have like the front of the Evening Herald has obviously the news about the upcoming general election, but then all of these attacks that happened on the night of the armistice, of Armistice Day. So they smash the windows of the Mansion House. You then have Liberty Hall. That comes under attack, where it's a concerted effort and it's organised that they are going to attack Liberty Hall. There was just clerks in the building. Women of the Irish Women's Workers Union were there having a meeting. And this is in response to Labour's attitude to the war. So this is like payback for that. And then Emma Hall up in Inchicore. Now that's right beside Richmond Barracks. That had been the home of Michael Mallon in 1916. And that was attacked, and that was still being used as a meeting place by the ITGWU and also so Cumann na mBan, the Anina branch Cumann na mBan. So all of these places were attacked on that night, but it's 6 Harcourt Street that gets
in the spirit notes of equality, and in the spirit of the fact that female suffrage has been extended to women. Women were prominently involved in the attacks, weren't they?
Yeah, that's what you have in a lot of the newspaper reports and so on. It's the separation women. It's the women whose husbands and sons either didn't come home or came home. And they're obviously venting their frustration, but also their happiness. And when you've got Sinn Féin flags flying in Harcourt Street and there's Union Jacks flying, it is a powder keg that just goes boom.
And sets the tone very nicely for the election that followed about 6 weeks later. Maeve, talking about women, a lot of women were in war jobs, proportionately perhaps not so many as in Britain, because proportionately not as many Irish men actually joined the armed forces. But a number of them were. What happened to them when the war ended? What happened to their jobs?
So these women who had either been involved in, say, the munitions factories, a very well-known one up in Parkgate Street, voluntary aid detachments as well. You can't kind of forget those women who may have not been paid for their work, but who gave up a huge amount of time and effort to be part of the war effort itself. A lot of these women, when the men did come home from war, were strongly discouraged to give up their jobs, and either they were forced to do so, or they would have been given something like a redundancy package, or if they were lucky, I suppose they would have been given that. But those women, somewhat like the separation women, were sometimes vilified by nationalist propaganda. The women who had jobs during the war were vilified by the new parliament and the new Dáil. By keeping their jobs, they were keeping a breadwinner from getting his job back. So, for example, women who had munitions factories, who had taken up tram drivers' roles as well, these women were actively discouraged to give up their role. So a lot of those women who had been given new opportunities of, say, leadership or organisational skills in factories or as voluntary aid detachments or even organising various charities were trying to forge new identities for themselves in this post-First World War era, but in the new Irish Parliament era as well, in the new Dáil era and times.
One would imagine also that some, at least, of the separation women were not necessarily looking forward to the return of the troops because they had gained an element of independence. Financial
well,
independence.
Absolutely. And one thing that Kieran and I were discussing just a little bit earlier was the fact that another thing that some of the men would be bringing home back to the home with them was venereal diseases. Mm. And this was a big concern not only for the Irish and British governments but also for people at home as well. And I've been doing some research to mark the centenary of a new institution next year, which is St Dalton's Hospital, which was back in 1919 originally founded as a venereal hospital for the treatment of returning soldiers. So this was a big concern for the women who had been at home and who were waiting for their husbands to come back from war as well.
They weren't just bringing back venereal diseases, they were bringing back shell shock, which is something that would not necessarily have been expected. Yeah. Kieran, one interesting reaction to soldiers coming home, which you've brought to our attention, is a campaign to ban drink in the immediate aftermath of the war. How come we were ahead of the Americans when it came to the notion of prohibition?
Surprising, isn't it? Well, maybe the war had destroyed the Irish whiskey industry, so maybe this is just trying to put the final nail in the cask. There was a campaign run out of Belfast, the Ulster Temperance Council, but it was advertised in the South, it was advertised in the Irish Independent in December 18, and it was talking about "When Daddy Comes Home" was the title of the campaign, and it urged women of Ireland to vote for a sober peace. And the idea was to urge women to contact their candidates or their people when they're being canvassed for their votes and say, "I'll vote for you, Mr. Candidate or Mrs. Candidate in 1918, if you will ensure that for 6 months there'll be no drink in Ireland while the men reintegrate into society." And it even quoted the fact that Americans were looking at prohibition at the same time. So this notion of sort of a worry or an anxiety about the changes in society coming back in, thousands of menfolk returning, shell shock, as you say, wasn't anticipated, but they knew there was going to be some disruption. I mean, perhaps the concern over drink masks a lot of other concerns where women had had financial independence, social independence, greater degree of sort of family control, and all that was going to change. But the idea of menfolk coming home, perhaps not being in work and drinking, and then disrupting a family that had lived without them for 4 years, a society that had lived without them for 4 years.
And this campaign, temperance campaign, originates in Belfast.
In Belfast, yeah. Mm.
So presumably they did not run out of beer in the Belfast pubs on Armistice Day, but you say they did in Dublin.
They did in Dublin. I'm pretty sure they did in Belfast too.
Maeve, was there a positive impact on women's identity as this time because of the fact that they got voting rights in February of 1918? Or did that, because only a small number of them actually got, they had to be over 30 years of age for a start, and there was also a property qualification, did it really make that much of a difference?
I think you really hit the nail on the head there with the fact that it was only certain women who did get the right to vote. And so many of the women who would have been involved in the war effort, for example, the ones that I mentioned earlier in the munitions factories, were often quite young women who probably weren't propertied or didn't have, say, a university degree or for qualification, or the women who had worked as voluntary aid detachments, who the soldiers apparently used to call very adorable darlings. So those women were usually in their late teens and early 20s and again wouldn't have benefited from this new franchise that women over 30 would have gotten in Ireland and Britain. But of course, another really important thing that did happen in November as well, 1918, was the fact that women could not only now vote, but they could also run for Parliament. So there were certain leadership roles that were then available for women, such as Countess Markievicz and Winifred Kearney, who were nominated through Sinn Féin. So
yeah, Winifred Kearney got a great constituency. She was running East Belfast.
I don't think anyone would have won it there, though, yeah. In terms of man or woman. But in terms of, say, we often talk about today, what the kind of leadership that young girls can look towards in our society today. But people like Countess Markievicz and Winifred Kearney, who got to run for Sinn Féin for the first time, would have been important figureheads for young women to look towards.
Maeve Casserly, Ciarán Wallace and Liz Gillis, many thanks for joining us to talk about the reaction to the armistice and events in Ireland in late 1918. Tonight, we've heard just some of the stories of those who fought, those who died, and those who came back from the war. We're going to hear now a personal family story. This is the actor and broadcaster Brian DeSalvo with an essay on his grandfather, Alf Newton.
A short downward stroke, perhaps the first mark made by primitive man to announce his presence. But this one isn't on a cave wall. It's written in pencil in the war diary of the 2nd 6th Battalion North Staffordshire Regiment for the 17th of April 1917. 1600 hours, Grand Priel Farm shelled during afternoon. Casualties, killed, officers, nil. Other ranks, one. The other rank was my maternal grandfather, Alf Newton. I ran to him, but he was beyond help, wrote stretcher-bearer Alfred Gunn to Newton's widow. He was killed instantly, a shell exploding quite close to him, a piece hitting him in the head. 242248, Private Alfred Newton, was a reluctant soldier. Not for him, your country needs you. With a small business to run and a wife and three small children, he had no need of anything other than domestic adventure. But the Military Service Bill of 1916 would make it clear that the professional army was to be fortified by conscription. Alf ran his own dairy delivery round, complete with horse and cart, from a yard in Bayswater. He homed his young family in the adjoining house. "What should I do about my business?" he asked. "Sell it," he was advised. You can sense the shrug. Alf enlisted in the North Staffordshire Regiment, a territorial force raised as a second-line unit kept in reserve. The definition meant little. Soon the Military Service Bill would remove the protection of married conscripts against serving abroad, and these men would be under fire soon after their arrival on the Western Front. They were ill-prepared. Training had been interrupted by the Easter Rising in Dublin, where, despite the protests of their commanding officer, they were regarded as reinforcements, not rookies in training. They were latecomers to the brief hostilities, arriving on the afternoon of Friday the 28th of April, when the fighting was more or less over. So Alf Newton arrived too late to contribute to the carnage. His company suffered only one casualty, Private Buckerfield, whose leg wound may well have saved his life. It invalided him out of the army. Most of his comrades perished on the Western Front. We next catch a glimpse of Alf writing a card to his children from the Ballykinla camp in Northern Ireland in October. The battalion remained in Ireland until January 1917. At 11:30 a.m. on the morning of the 25th of February 1917, 31 officers and 653 other ranks of the 6th Battalion North Staffs arrived by train at Southampton. At 4 p.m. they embarked for Le Havre. Conditions were crowded and unpleasant, but as nothing compared to what was to come. Less than 18 months later, Alf Newton's battalion had ceased to exist, the few that had escaped annihilation in Bordon Wood being incorporated into the 1st Battalion. Alf himself had escaped the horror of the gas-filled wood. He was safely tucked up in his grave in what is now once again the picturesque village of Joncourt. It is some bizarre comfort that his ordeal lasted less than 2 months. Alf was a fringe victim of the overambitious plan of French General Robert Nivelle to end World War I within 48 hours. It was mainly a French offensive on the Hindenburg Line. Alf's battalion was merely a diversion on the eastern flank. It proved a disaster. The French troops mutinied, and less than a month later, its author was replaced by Pétain. Nivelle lost his job, but unlike many thousands of the men he sent over the top, not his life, dying a natural death at the age of 67. Lloyd George was 82 when he succumbed to cancer, with his wife and daughter at his bedside. Haig exited this life aged 66 and was honoured with a state funeral. These men were not evil. They chanced to be in command during a most dreadful hour. An apologist for Haig wrote that his high casualty rate was a function of the tactical and strategic realities of the time. the style of language is revealing, indicating a class that disposed and another that was disposable. Alf Newton was 32 when he stumbled unwillingly into the latter category. I hope this war will soon be over, don't you, Dad? The question from his 7-year-old daughter Elsie remained unanswered, her letter unread. For her father, the war was over. Instead of the return, the ritual of the boy with the dreaded telegram, the newly ordained widow staggering in the doorway, a fluttering of children, the neighbours moving swiftly in to take charge. Then the ultimate irony, the arrival of the widow's penny, cast in heavy bronze gunmetal, and a scroll commending one who, at the call of king and country, left all that was dear to them, giving up their own lives that others may live in freedom. The short downward stroke in the battalion diary was a more accurate tribute.
Brian DeSalvo there with that essay telling the story of his own maternal grandfather, Alf Newton. That piece was researched, written and voiced by Brian DeSalvo with production by Robert Diggins. We're just about out of time on tonight's programme. My thanks to Mark Dwyer on sound and our researcher Liz Gillis. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. We're going to leave you tonight with some music. No Man's Land, also known as the Green Fields of France, is one of the most enduring anti-war songs of the 20th century, written by the great Eric Bogle. This rendition by Declan O'Rourke was recorded for this programme back in 2014. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.
Well, how do you do, young Willie McBride? Do you mind if I sit here down by your graveside and rest for a while neath the warm summer sun? I've been walking all day and I'm nearly done. I see by your gravestone you were only 19 when you joined the great fallen in 1916. Well, I hope you died well and I hope you died clean. Or young Willie McBride, was it slow and obscene? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did you leave her a wife or a sweetheart behind? In some faithful heart is your memory a shrine? And though you died back in 1916, in that faithful heart are you forever 19? Or are you a stranger without even a name, enclosed in forever behind the glass frame? In an old photograph torn, battered and stained, and faded to yellow in a brown leather frame. Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Well, the sun, now it shines on the green fields of France. There's a warm summer breeze that makes the red poppies dance. And look how the sun shines from under the clouds. There's no gas, no barbed wire, there's no guns firing down. But here in this graveyard, it's still no man's land. The countless white crosses stand mute in the sand. Through man's blind indifference to his fellow man, and a whole generation that were butchered and damned. Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? Did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? While young Willie McBride, I can't help wonder why. Did those that lie here know why did they die? And did they believe when they answered the call? Did they really believe that this war would end wars? Well, the sorrow, the suffering, the glory, the pain, the killing and dying were all done in vain. For young Willie McBride, it all happened again and again and again and again and again. Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest? Did they beat the drums slowly? Did they play the fife lowly? Did they sound the death march as they lowered you down? And did the band play the last post and chorus? And did the pipes play the flowers of the forest?